done.
Woo! Welcome.
This is Hope. Today's episode of According to Your Purpose, we have Peachy Keenan. This is actually a really interesting episode for us because Peachy isn't even her real name. It's a moniker. She's completely anonymous online, which is why her identity is concealed in this episode. She's done everything from write jokes for sitcoms to writing a speech for President Trump. In this episode, we got to talk about what it means to be truly countercultural in a world gone insane. We got to talk about her new book, Domestic Extremist, which is essentially a how-to guide on how to be extremely domestic. It's an awesome conversation. Here's my talk with Peachy. Thank you for doing this. I'm excited. This is I've been a fan of your writing for a long time, so I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
To begin, tell me a little bit about your background. I presume that when you, 20 years ago, you didn't think you were going to be a comedic Catholic influencer.
That's an accurate statement. I had no idea this is where I would end up. Like I wrote about in my book, Domestic Extremists. Domestic extremists are made, not born. I was certainly not like this 20 years ago as a young woman. And for me, it was just a slow evolution. You know, I would say that, I went to sort of like the meritocratic, private school route. I went to grade high school. I was sort of groomed for, high academic achievement. So that meant going to the best school I got into. So I went to a great, at the time, a prestigious university. And at the end, I popped out and I was sort of basic, liberal, pro-choice, feminist, but we weren't very political. This is the 90s, so politics wasn't like looming large for us. I didn't really care about elections or anything, but culturally, I was just a full-blown, liberal feminist, because that's what everyone was. I didn't even meet a Republican or a conservative or, a Christian or anyone religious, really. Until much, much later in my life. I mean, just 100% of my contacts with the world were in this sort of like liberal, coastal, bi-coastal, whatever, elite milieu. And that means at work, my friends. And so for me, it was sort of a slow evolution. And I like to say that I escaped liberal feminism by the skin of my teeth. I somehow, by the time I was sort of hitting my late 20s, my friends and I had all spent our 20s just doing what girls did in those days, and I think they're still doing it now, which is just having fun and dating and not really thinking about anything like the future or forming families or finding a spouse. Like, that was just not something that we thought down the road. One of these days that will, of course, happen, but we're not going to worry about it. We're not going to do anything to sort of prepare ourselves, for that stage of our lives. And so we did not. We were not prepared. And then, I had a kind of political red pilling first, and that really happened. My parents were sort of Reagan normicons, but I rejected that. I thought they were, incredibly cringe for believing, liking Ronald Reagan. But I did have some residual kind of patriotic, which is, old-fashioned American values. And so when 9/11 happened, that was like an incredible political red pilling, just like instantly overnight, And I felt like all my kind of like democratic, liberal, political kind of tendencies just totally fell away. And like many people that day, that week. But then it wasn't until I started dating my now husband that I sort of started dabbling in, more conservative cultural ideas. Like, for example, he's a great debater, and we would have debates all the time about, let's say, for example, abortion. And again, I was totally pro-choice. I had, you know, had arguments with my mother that, like, if my little sister ever got pregnant, Mom, I would take her to get an abortion. I would never tell you. I mean, and that was just, you know, and she was horrified, but I had no other kind of scaffolding, you know, for my belief system. I had not been raised. I was raised in a very secular, you know, atheist, LA, you know, world. And, you know, I never set foot in any kind of, you know, place of worship ever. And I didn't know anyone who did. So, I mean, it was just, of course, I was not going to, how would I ever have had any understanding about something like abortion? I just, every message I got from the culture was, this is something that is good. And if you need to have one, it's fine. And don't worry about it. And so when I had this argument with my, at the time, boyfriend, he, for some miracle, honestly, was, he had also converted from pro-choice to pro-life. And so we were debating all of this. And he finally just made some really poignant arguments to me. And I was left defending this position, which obviously is untenable, which is, you know, okay, abortion is murder, but it's still the mother's choice if she wants to do that. And then, you know, you can't really support that position very long. And so that was sort of the beginning of, I like to say, my domestic extremism.
What's so interesting to me about your writing at The American Mind, and I've been following it for a while, was I think you were talking, you tend to be ahead of the curve on a lot of these cultural issues, specifically domestic extremism. So it was, you know, these things that were closely held and traditional 10 seconds ago are now, you know, taboo. We, you know, and you wrote a post a long time ago, it may have been one of your early posts, about the niceness with Christians. So I was actually having lunch with a buddy of mine, and he had brought a friend of his, and he was asking about the show. And he said, the first thing he asked me, he said, is your show mean? That was the first question. I was like, well, I don't think it's mean. I was like, it's cultural. I was like, we, you know, talk about our values, but I don't think it's mean. But how do you think as a culture that we have gotten to this point where, you know, housewives are extremists and you're not a Christian if you're not nice? You know, you can't stand up for anything. Everything is taboo.
Yeah, that's so funny. That essay that you're talking about, that was actually my first ever essay for The American Mind. It was called, "And You Call Yourself a Christian?" And I heard that, like, I think someone accused that of Tucker Carlson or something on TV. And I was like, I kept hearing that people accusing Christians of being evil because they, let's say, supported border control or, you know, weren't in favor of, you know, women's reproductive health care or whatever, and that you were just evil and not Christian if you were, you know, let's say, believe were pro-life or wanted, you know, immigration restrictions in any form. And that was just so hilarious to me, because here's these people who have literally no morals, are, you know, promoting, you know, transgender genital mutilation in little kids, and they're daring to accuse, let's say, a devout Christian of being a bad person because they don't agree with what they're saying. And I just, and it's just, I just find it so ironic. I mean, I didn't convert to Catholicism. I finally did, let's say, almost 10 years ago. And since then, it's just been amazing to see the reaction when people hear that someone like me is a practicing Catholic, what they call trad Cath, go to mass every Sunday. The kids are, you know, fully bought in. It's sort of shocking to them. It's almost like, and this is where my book came out of, is I became treated like, with my former peers, like an extremist, like an actual dangerous extremist, a lunatic. She doesn't believe in the things we believe in very strongly. Who is this person? Like, how can this be? And I thought it was so funny because, and that's what the title of the book is. It's sort of like this joke that people who are, when I say domestic extremists, I just mean extremely domestic. You know, you believe in monogamous marriage, you believe in having families and raising them with sort of what we call old fashioned values, but really they used to just be normal stuff, right? Like two genders and all the rest of it. And I started, just because I was sort of living my life like that differently than people I had known when I was younger, I was suddenly an extremist. And I just thought it was very funny. But in terms of the meanness thing, yeah, people, my take is that, you know, they hate us, right, for what we believe in. But when Jesus said, don't just love your neighbors, you have to love your enemies, and that's quite profound. And so I definitely do try to resist hating our enemies, even though they, you know, want us dead or want to close our churches or want to call us all these names. I definitely resist hating them, but I do pray for their eternal souls.
It seems like the America of, you know, the boomers, that our parents didn't deal with this issue. What do you think changed in, like, the, I guess, like, the milieu of the country that kind of led us down this path?
Yeah, that's a great question. I like to say, you know, I don't want to, everyone wants to go back and return to the past. I don't want to go back to the 1780s. I will take the 1980s. You know what I mean? That was fine. I mean, I think what changed is that just the, you know, the long march through the institutions, starting in the 50s and 60s with all the waves of the various waves of feminism, probably starting with the second wave of feminism. And the boomers were all in to the, you know, bra burning and sexual liberation and all that stuff, the sexual revolution and the birth control pill. And I really think that those things, you know, it's sort of like that, that domino meme where the first domino is just a very small thing, like, cool, you can prevent pregnancy with this little medicine. And then the final domino is like total collapse of Western civilization. So I think all of those things, and just amplified by just, you know, just the total dominance of our culture from, you know, left-wing people in our institutions. We have no escape. There's someone who isn't getting a kind of contradictory message at home from their parents or from their school or whatever, they're just, of course, going to be fully bought in to, you know, whatever mainstream American culture, which is just, you know, feminism and promiscuity and all the rest of it.
What do you think has changed with Gen X and millennials that has made them more interested in taking the culture head on?
Okay, thank you for bringing this up. So I think that I'm, like, solidly Generation X. I actually don't hate the baby boomers. I don't hate the millennials. You know, can we all get along? But I think that Generation X occupies a little bit of a special place in our culture and has a secret weapon, which is why people say they're the most conservative generation. You know, not all of us, obviously, but we are, because it's very simple. We didn't have any technology until we were all, like, out of college, basically. We didn't have any social media, any cell phones, nothing, like zero. Like, we just sort of got through it all just old fashioned style. So our childhoods were way more like our parents' childhoods than our own children's childhoods. I mean, it's just night and day. And I do think that being able to get through our formative years without the just constant fire hose of, like, you know, the culture here was very helpful. I mean, we did have MTV. Okay, and Madonna. So we weren't like totally isolated, but I think that is one of our secret weapons, and also just the sort of cynicism and you know, total disregard for authority. I mean, I'm guilty of that totally. I mean, I wasn't like fighting with police officers or whatever, but I was definitely like, you know, we're eye rolling our professors. We were just like, we didn't want to listen to higher authorities, and that actually, maybe that didn't serve us so well in college or whatever, but it serves us very well now, where there's just, you know, the buffoons, our buffoonish overlords are just so comical. I mean, they're bad and they're evil and they're scary, but they're also so comical that we just can see through all this stuff, you know?
So why did you decide to write your book on domestic extremism in the form of, like, I guess, family and family life and religion, as opposed to, I don't know, a traditional kind of political conservative book?
Well, I mean, I think that, well, first of all, I am, you know, I'm a woman, and women are supposed to be interested in politics. No, I'm just kidding. I've been feeling more and more the last few years. I mean, I've written tons about politics. I wrote, you know, I wrote like a speech for Trump when the pandemic happened.
Oh, really?
That got published. Yeah, that got like a lot of people like were into that. But I've been feeling the last couple of years that we really can't solve the problems here politically. Like yes, there is a political solution, but I think it would be very ugly. And I'm not really sure what it would look like. And, you know, one election or two elections or, well, we'll get them next time. That's not really getting us where we want to be. So I really felt strongly that, well, maybe the best place to focus is on the cultural issues, on the social issues. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, at the end of the day, whoever's in the White House or your senator or whatever, okay, like, how much does it affect you in terms of, like, your children not hating you when they're older? You know, how does that affect, like, your daughter not growing up and being on Tinder and, you know, having the sort of, like, unpaid OnlyFans lifestyle? You know, like, we used to joke, like, how do you keep your daughter off the pole? Now it's like, how do you keep your daughter off the dating apps, right? So for me, that felt like just a more, no pun intended, fertile territory to mm-hmm. explore. And it's really like, I just felt like because I had had this sort of conversion from, you know, liberal, whatever, mainstream feminism to just a total 180. I just thought that would maybe be an interesting story to write about.
You know, what's interesting is, especially with Gen Z, there's like it's starting to kind of crack a little bit. There's like a percolation with these young kids that the culture is collapsing so quickly that you're starting to see them kind of yearn for something different. And it's not much, but did you see that clip? The podcast is called Whatever, but it's basically a guy in like the light girl. She's like, and she said like 30 times in a 1 minute clip. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Sad.
What was, you know, everybody was dunking on the girl, but what was fascinating to me and really sad was she didn't have the language to express the issues, but what she was saying is she was really unhappy with modern dating. And that's what mm-hmm. she was trying to express, is that she was being treated like an object, but she didn't have the language to express that. And it seems like there's more and more people kind of interested in a more traditional lifestyle. It's like it's almost like a biological, natural yearning for that thing mm-hmm. that we've totally erased from culture.
Mm-hmm. You know, the best analogy for me is like Soviet dissidents who leave Mother Russia, you know, and move to the United States and are now trying to warn us about the evils of communism. Like they lived through that. They lived through, you know, the Iron Curtain and all that stuff. And so I think that, you know, modern young women are kind of experiencing what the consequences of their choices are, like in real time. And they're like, whoa, this sucks. This is the way to live. And this is going to give me happiness and freedom and whatever. I can do whatever I want. I can just be like a man and date however many guys I want. And they're finding in practice that doesn't work out that way. And I'm seeing so many of those videos on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter about young women in the dating world just coming back, you know, coming out of the arena kind of bloodied and battered and saying like, you guys, like, don't go in there. Like, we got to find a different way. Like that, it this is not good for us. Like, what is this? And there's just no guideposts for them.
Well, it's funny that feminism has largely been a, you know, they're anti-patriarchal, but their demands on society are very male in nature, that like they act as men, they date as men. And it's like, well, if you think casual sex is like you're winning, it's like you're kind of giving the dude exactly what he wants. You're not protecting women. You're kind of giving men exactly what they want. But ironically, I don't think it's what men need either, which kind of leads to the Andrew Tate types. And mm-hmm. but it's a fascinating thing. And it's heartbreaking. And I'm single. It's a nightmare out there.
Dating, I'm sure. I hear that from young men too. They're like, where do I find, you know, want me to get married? Like, where is she? I'm like, okay, I'm working on it. Like, we have to like save the girls. I hear you. Yeah.
Do you think women are going to be the thing that changed the culture just by the nature of them kind of controlling how dating works?
I mean, I think so. I mean, we have to do like a Lysistrata move, you know, the play. The women have to just like withhold sex from men, just get off the apps and then see what happens. Because they say, well, it's not just us. We're not, you know, you're calling us like slutty or whatever. But here's the men who are using the apps just as they're going crazy. They're dating millions of girls. Like, it's not just, this is not just the women who are kind of, you know, taking advantage of it. The men are fully engaged also. And so there has to be kind of a change on both sides. But like, I think I just have, you know, I can't, I'm not like a, you know, a male, like, you know, self-help person. I think just because of my experience, I probably have better luck talking to girls or women and just, you know, advising them on like, these mistakes are easily avoided. You know, they're so easily avoided and you're not going to get where you want to go. And you may have a lot of regrets, and there's another way to live. And I think that no one is telling them that. Like, who's going to tell, you know, a 25-year-old girl that, like, actually you should probably put some clothes on, you know, stop partying so much. I mean, you know, everything in moderation. I mean, that's just old grandma wisdom, but it's really true.
Yeah, it's, you know, and there's some men starting to kind of see the issues with like the Andrew Tate logic, right? Because it's like, you know, he goes out there, and I think what I've heard, you know, I think Ben Shapiro described him like that, is Andrew Tate has a very good idea about how to diagnose issues, but his remedy to those issues is completely backwards, right? He says like the culture's broken, dating's broken, but then he encourages guys to, you know, work and make lots of money and then sleep with lots of girls. Right. And it's like, what I would want to tell those guys is to say, hey, like, largely, you're probably not going to make that much money. You're probably going to make like a moderate amount of money. You could just get married to a woman who loves you and have kids that are obsessed with you. Like, that's a much easier and better way path to happiness than to double down on the culture that brought you into the pit that got you there, right?
Oh, yeah. I had a teenage son who, when Andrew Tate was sort of blowing up, he and his friends got really, you know, got really interested, and they were in him, and they were walking around saying, like, you know, top G. I'm a top G. Like, they were fully, and I was like, I remember I had seen him on Twitter. Like, I didn't dig too, I'm not his demographic, okay? So I didn't, like, dig too deeply. I didn't really know what it was. And they were all talking about Andrew Tate. And I started looking into it, and I asked my son, like, well, okay, like, I'm all for, you know, just like a counterbalance to like feminized, emasculating cultural influences, which are all we have. Like, I'm totally okay with some kind of like, you know, maybe super masculine guy who's sort of inspiring them to embrace their inner whatever. I don't know. But then when I found out about his, you know, slightly less savory remarks, I was like, you know, it's probably better to not, you know, watch those things. So, but that, you know, having said that, there is a huge vacuum for anyone who can talk to teenage boys and like tell them like, it's okay to be male. Like, good. Like, we need you to stay male. Like, we need as many intact males with their, you know, with their intact body parts as possible, who are willing to go out there and like scoop up a girl and marry her and be loyal to her. And yes, it's not about like, you know, shagging lots of women. That I would say that's in a way anti-masculine, and that the strongest masculine virtue, and really one of the hardest things you can do and the most courageous thing, is like committing to someone and whatever children you have with her and saying like, I'm gonna be here, you know, I'm gonna be with you, and that's it. And I think that is incredibly precious. And I think that there are men out there who want to do that and are ready to do that. And it's just a question of the math adding up. Like, okay, here's these young men who want to, you know, commit to someone, and how do we get the women to the same level so we can kind of like match everybody up? Because like I just tweeted, I tweeted earlier this week, you know, the future belongs to heterosexual breeding pairs. Sorry. Like, is that hate speech? Like, that's just real. Like, that's just biology.
Yeah. Literally true. It can only belong to heterosexual breeding pairs.
Like, that's how it works at the zoo, too. Like, when you have the endangered rhinos, you're going to need a man and a woman rhino to save the species, like we do, too.
I think Jordan Peterson and Joe Rogan kind of speak into those areas, too. Who do you think in the female space is kind of speaking to women in that way?
I have some, you know, online friends who are writers, and actually two of them have just put out recently fabulous books that everyone here should read. Louise Perry, The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. She's British. And then another Brit, Mary Harrington's book, Feminism Against Progress. So those are both sort of dabbling in the same sort of general area that I am, which is just sort of pointing out the lies that contemporary modern women have been sold, and offering us some solutions for ways out. I mean, I think that this sort of like new literary genre is very cool, and it's very interesting. Like, when I found out that they both had these books coming out, you know, right around the time that my book is coming out, it made me excited, because it's like, maybe there is really something going on here. You know, maybe this is more than just a trad wife meme on Twitter. There is real truth here and real movement happening to sort of wake young women up.
Oh, I think it's definitely happening. There's a whole new wave of really interesting female thinkers. We had Abigail Favale a couple weeks ago, and she's awesome. I think Bridget Fetissi is super cool.
Bridget's great. My friend Helen Roy has a great podcast called Girl Boss Interrupted. And I think she's interviewed Abigail. And it's wonderful. It's on you can find it on YouTube. And she's addressing these exact issues
too. Yeah, have you seen all those articles about the trad wives, that they're dangerous?
You know, it's really funny that you say that, because I have been working on a new Substack post about this, and I had technical issues, so I wasn't able to finish it. It'll be coming out later. I'm calling it The Real Trad Wives of America. And yeah, I looked at that. That woman who went viral, Estee Williams, who was like the very adorable baby doll, you know, busty. She's like a TikTok star, because she's cooking for her husband and explaining her that that's what she likes to do. And people obviously triggered everybody, triggered all the people, all the right people. And they were saying that this is just a fetish, you know, this is a sex fetish or whatever. I mean, I think she is genuine. I think that, you know, I don't necessarily approve of, like, displaying your cleavage prominently. I understand, like, that's how you get views. I understand that. Yeah. But just please know that I will not be doing videos like that. I'm sorry to disappoint all of my readers.
Well, it's so funny, because it's like the Atlantic or whoever it was, Vice, is like, this is a dangerous trend, and it's like they can't let the cat out of the bag that, like, you can just be happy, you know, you can just get married and be happy. That's right. They're like, this is dangerous. You can't be acting as if people acted for the last 5,000 years.
Right. It's extremist.
So tell me about your book.
It's called Domestic Extremist: The Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. You can pre-order it now on Amazon or wherever books are sold. And it comes out on D-Day, coincidentally, June 6th, which is funny. And so what I did in the book is I sort of tried to figure out, you know, my editor was like, you have to write a book about this, but it has to be like Ebola. You know, you want to, that's his analogy for books. You want to present the problem and make it dire, and then try to present the solution that only you can present. So that's sort of a good key. Anyone out there writing a nonfiction book, you want to present the Ebola and the cure for Ebola, okay, in your book. So that's what I tried to do. You won't actually get Ebola, I hope, reading it. So, you know, the first half of the book is about, like, how we got here, like, what everything we lost, our feminine virtues, our unborn children, our maternal instinct. That seems to have been severed in too many women, or damaged somehow. You know, our feelings about marriage, like, what exactly happened here? What are all these feminist waves? Like, who's doing this? Who's directing us? I actually quote Helen in the book, on one of her podcasts, she asked the question, which is so basic, like, whose idea was feminism anyway? You know, like, who are these, like, nefarious people who made us all kind of miserable and alone living in our atomized, you know, pod life? And the second half of the book is really, I tried to make it as practical as possible. This is not like an academic treatise. Like, you don't need a PhD mm-hmm. to read it, you know. I tried to make it really fun throughout, but also real, like with real actionable things that people can do. But look, it starts with like just like a very simple thing you can do like today, this second, which is just a mindset shift, you know, which is deciding like, okay, this is what I don't want. This is what I do want. Now, how do I have to change? Like, what do I need to do to like get out of this sort of like, you know, dead end?
Do you think most people in their heart of hearts want what you're selling here?
I mean, I think so. I think there's a lot of people who have kind of been psyoped into not wanting it, or they've been like distracted by these like kind of outlandish new relationship models that are promoted all the time in the New York Times, like open marriage, you know, polyamory or whatever, you know, single motherhood, great. And there's just no difference between any of them. They're all equally wonderful for you and you should try it out. And maybe if your husband doesn't pick up his socks, you know, it's time to leave him and your children. And there's just article after article kind of enticing women to disengage themselves from whatever traditional lifestyle they accidentally fell into and like promising them, you know, the promised land is you and your Brooklyn walk up with your cat, you know, like that's much better. And, you know, you'll just be more, you'll be happier. And so I'm trying to help people sort of reject that idea that no, like the results are in. And I looked at some charts that showed this incredible, there was a famous Wharton study that was done, what year was it? It was a while ago. It was like maybe 10 or 12, 15 years ago. And it accidentally became this sort of like taboo Wharton study that showed that since, you know, whatever, women's liberation or whenever women were able to, you know, start getting high-powered corporate jobs and going to graduate school and all that stuff, that their levels of happiness plummeted. And so the Wharton mm-hmm. study, and I cite it in my book, it's really interesting. And I think people were not happy about those results because it just showed the lie that you can have it all and be so happy. And like, no, in fact, maybe you can't. Like, why are antidepressant rates, you know, skyrocketing for older women? Like, why? What happened? And I think it was, you know, working in the corporate world was sort of like a big confirmation for me also, which I, you know, I was in after I had my second to last child. I got an opportunity to go back to sort of like, quote, my dream job in an office, full corporate, giant corporation. And I would see these young women come back after going on maternity leave. And they would just come back after 6 weeks. And I'd say like, you know, well, oh, where's your baby? You know, oh, he's in daycare. What they called it, school. He's at school. And it's just like, oh, no thanks. And then I got pregnant. I had like a surprise pregnancy. And I just left and never went back.
I find it interesting that earlier that you said that you would not want to go back to the past when, you know, I mean, it sounds like the past has a lot to offer, right? A more traditional and all ways of living, you know, it might offer more happiness in the way that we're living currently. Why do you want to hold on to the current culture in any capacity?
Okay, good question. Well, I just think there's a reality issue, which is, you know, the only way we're going back to a, you know, pre-internet past is like a, you know, EMP attack that sends us back too far.
Yeah.
I don't want to go back to the, you know, 1700s. And there's no way to go back. And if you try to sort of live that, you know, kind of old-fashioned lifestyle, it's sort of, you know, you come across as a LARPer. I mean, there's just no way. There's no way to get the iPhone out of your pocket. There's, you know, you can take some of the apps off your phones, which is probably a good thing. I just think we need to have a, you know, in order to survive the coming era, we do need to cling on to the kind of like basic fundamental things, which aren't even really like the past. It's not just like the past invented these things. These are things that come baked in to like every human ever. Mm-hmm. you know, like the desire that a, you know, the desire a child has to be with his mother. You know, that's not like a past thing. That's just all humans ever. And so, you know, or not wanting to be lonely as you grow old. That's not a past thing. There have always been lonely people. But the desire not to be lonely is just a human thing from, you know, we've had that for a million years. And so I guess I'm saying we can't go back to the past and we shouldn't go back to the past. But we should just kind of remember these fundamental desires of humans that aren't, I don't mean desire for, you know, watching porn or gambling or, you know, drinking or whatever. I'm talking about these kind of inner, these deep seated desires, the ones that are, the ones that count and the ones that will basically help you stave off, you know, the abyss.
Do you think all these like hyper trad accounts that are popping up, do you think they do a disservice to what you're trying to offer is maybe like a more modern approach?
I think that's great. I mean, I think that, you know, I applaud anybody who is able to create any sort of self-sufficiency for themselves. That's awesome. Like homeschooling parents and people who have a, an urban garden on their New York City walk up, or they actually went and bought, literally bought a farm. Like God bless them. Like they're going to do a lot better than me in the zombie apocalypse. You know, I'm sort of screwed. But when I wrote the book, I was very clear that when I don't want to set up something that's too aspirational for people, you know, like when someone tells me like, oh, gosh, the only way we're going to survive is you have to right now pack up and liquidate and leave California and you have to move to Montana and buy a ranch and like raise cows and sheep and things and chickens, you know, like that's so daunting. Like that's so daunting for anyone who didn't grow up like that. And believe me, I have never like touched a chicken or a cow. And like, I hope I never have to. Do you know what I mean? Like, I have no desire. Like, I would love someone to provide me fresh eggs, but like, I'm not going to do that part of it. Okay, I'm sorry. Like Woody Allen says, I am two with nature. Like, I'm sorry. I'm not going to go live in the woods. I won't fare very well. But I think that, you know, I think that if you... that becoming a domestic extremist or whatever, embracing a kind of more domestic mindset, it has nothing to do with like growing food, you know, being a survivalist or a prepper or any of that stuff. That's great stuff to do anyway. Everyone should do a little of that. It has to do with protecting your children and like their minds and kind of ensuring that they don't, trying your best to make sure that they don't grow up and just become, you know, part of the Borg.
You're based out of LA, right?
Yes.
How is that? Do you have any community around you? Are you solo in your ideals?
I can do this alone. I'm a born and bred Southern Californian, and I've lived in other places. I've lived in New York and Europe, and I went to school on the East Coast. But I always came back to California because like, it's, you know, I'm sorry, like, well, this past couple of weeks has really sucked, but the weather is just so good. You know, I'm like a salamander who can only exist on like one tree branch on one island in the South Pacific. Like I just don't do well in extreme cold or extreme heat. It's sad though, living here, you know, especially in Los Angeles. I live on the kind of the outskirts of the middle of the city, and it's sad. It's what's happened is sad, but I finally do have a little community around me of my fellow domestic extremists. Not the violent kind. I'm talking about like, you know, breastfeeding, homeschooling mother extremists. Okay.
Yeah.
But for many years, for most of my life, I didn't have anyone. I was totally in the closet in our old neighborhood. We were, you know, outcasts. You know, whenever people would see us, like getting all the kids in the car going to mass, we would get weird looks. I had one neighbor lived near me, and she saw me once coming out of, you know, going home, and she saw that I was pregnant, and she asked me like, "Are you pregnant again?" And I was like, "Yes." And she's like, "Is this number three?" You know, it was number three. And I said, "Yes." And she said, "What are you, some kind of Mormon?" Okay, so that's what we're living with. And, you know, when I worked at my corporate job, I was obviously by that point, a fully red pilled, like the kids say, based conservative. And I was surrounded by, basically open communists, like maybe some Bernie Bros. But if anyone had known like what I thought about the election, the 2016 election or anything, I would have just been instantly not just fired, but like tarred and feathered, tossed out the window, run over with a car. Like they were not going to have it. And one person actually asked me, and I was getting ready to leave. You know, I had gotten pregnant again and I already had a bunch of children at home. And in their minds, she has enough children. And so one person who was my friend said, I'm just curious, like, why didn't you decide to abort this one?
Oh, man.
I was like 7-8 months pregnant. And I was like, okay. Yeah, I just wanted, I didn't get mad at her. I understand their mindset. They just can't, they can't even comprehend, you know, why would you want another one?
That's so crazy to me. Mm-hmm. We're based out of Louisiana, so it's a little bit different here, but I can't even imagine. I can imagine not wanting kids. I can't imagine thinking that it's weird. You know, it feels like a different world.
Yeah. I mean, two is fine. Like, you know, we always used to joke, like once you have more than two, then you enter like the freak territory in my neck of the woods. Most people have two. That's it. Two. And the minute you have a third, it's like, whoa. How are you going to fit three car seats in the Range Rover? Like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And then once you have four, there's no more hiding. It's like a neck tattoo. You know, people see you coming, four kids, like lock the doors. Here comes that freak. Like people can't process, I mean, and look, I know lots of women who have way more than the number of kids I have, like a lot more. But even I get treated like some kind of circus freak. It's really funny, actually. I enjoy it.
When you were changing your perspective when you were young, was being in LA, being in California, a deterrent? Were you embarrassed or nervous about these new beliefs, being like joining the club of the bad people,
Yeah. The funny thing is there's like more Trump voters in California than there are in like half the Midwestern states combined. But the problem is that everybody is hiding. So nobody knows. we need like a special pin to like see the other, the guy in Trader Joe's like, oh, he agrees with you. But like people would say like, I just talked to this, like the guy at the car wash. He told me he loved Trump. Oh my gosh. Like you would freak out when you kind of met another conservative in the wild. It's like this big event. You tell your friends, like the guy at the In-N-Out gave me a thumbs up for my whatever snag I had or whatever. But what you would never do is you would never display any sign that you were not on board with the full blown Democrat program. Like, for example, if you wore a MAGA hat, walking around, let's say West Hollywood, okay, you probably wouldn't survive two blocks. Like you would get knifed outside Barney's Beanery. Okay. Like you have your throat slit in front of Romans, like you're done. And so you have to be very careful, but sometimes like in the last election, every car had a Hillary sticker, or what's the last, what am I talking, 2016, every single car had a Hillary sticker. And so the cars that didn't have any stickers, that's how you would know.
Really?
Like, oh, there you go. Yeah, it's scary. I mean, it really is scary. I mean, in my neighborhood, there's trans flags on windows, and there's, a lot of houses in 2020 had the BLM sign in the window, in this house, we believe, that sign. You just have to, it's good though. I like to see that because then I know where we shouldn't send the kids to trick or treat.
I've heard it described as like the poisonous frogs. Like if they have like blue hair, don't like approach.
Yeah, don't go over there. You won't get good treats.
Exactly.
They'll give you like organic nuts. Like you don't, no chocolate. You'll get some twigs and berries. Like,
it's edible and has weed in it or something. When you met your husband, was he a Republican? Was he conservative?
he was sort of a newly red-pilled. We didn't have that phrase back then. He had been a kind of like me, had like kind of Reaganite parents. Because I mean, you know, in the 80s in California, like a lot of people were Republicans. We had Republican governors over and over and over again. It was not unusual to have people in Los Angeles who like loved Ronald Reagan and thought of themselves as Republicans. So it wasn't like now it'd be weird. But he had, like me, gone through high school and college and was graduated as a basic lib, you know. And in graduate school, he had met some friends who were like, you know, conservative Christians, Orthodox Jews, various conservatives. He had never met any, ever, had never even met a conservative. And so he had kind of, you know, and I think he was volunteering for like the Clinton campaign. Like he was fully on board.
Yeah.
And then he kind of had this slow red pilling also, but before me. And I think for him also, 9/11, you know, was like the full blown neocon moment, you know, like, okay, like, you know, we're not, you know, we are committing to the dark side after that.
9/11 was the watershed moment because it was kind of the death of postmodernism for you, that all cultures are not created equal. Is that the thing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess like I said, I had been raised to, you know, even though I was, you know, liberal, I had been always raised to be patriotic and believe that America was good. You know, okay, now I kind of have extremely mixed feelings about that. But, you know, my grandfather was a veteran of World War II, and so was my great uncle. So I would hear all these stories and, oh my gosh, you know, the Yanks were the good guys and stuff. So I just already always had that, you know, marching in the July 4th parade as a Girl Scout. Like that was just my childhood, just basic, kind of like very kind of old fashioned ideals. And so 9/11 was, you know, what happened was horrible and terrible. But then that night, and I actually wrote about this in the book, that night I watched on TV, I was in California, that in the NYU students, we're already having like a prayer, like a candlelight circle, drum circle, like condemning America that night. In Union Square, they had a huge rally against, you know, Bush and railing against this country. And it was very much like, this is the chickens coming home to roost. You know, we deserve this and stuff. And so I just kind of naturally, like, that didn't sit well with me, you know, like, wasn't like a truther or anything like that. I just thought, well, that's, I don't like those. Look at these dirty little hippies, you know? I was like,
yeah,
no way. And so that was just, you know, where I just naturally went.
I have friends that are nervous to get married, kind of with the way marriage is going and the, you know, I don't know, all sorts of different reasons. Mm. What would you say would be your pitch to people that are nervous about getting married?
Wait, Why are they nervous?
You know, I think it's divorce is high. Marriage laws, I think they're nervous that they could lose their kids or lose their money or, you know,
right,
things like that. And I also think it's like the ease with which there are options now, you know, with dating apps. And, you know, it's very easy to just cut off and move on. I don't know. It doesn't feel like the right environment for, I want to get married, you know, but I have friends that don't. What would be your pitch to those people on why marriage is important?
Well, you know, a couple of things. First of all, like I'm not surprised at all that some men feel that way, because I've heard from men that the women that are on these apps, you know, I have a very close friend who's divorced and he is on the apps, and I hear reports. And he's like, you know, you wouldn't believe what they're like. They're just like, he described the women as, you know, they'll sleep with you just like they're brushing their teeth. It's just another thing to do that night. It's like part of their like getting ready for bed, you know, routine is like sleeping with someone they just met that day. That lifestyle probably doesn't make someone marriage material. So like, if that's who they're meeting, yeah, I get it. They don't want to make a mistake and marry someone who is living that lifestyle, like on the merry-go-round, on the Tinder merry-go-round, because it's unlikely to work out. But I also say that, look, not everyone should get married. I'm not an absolutist. I'm a total realist. It's about numbers, But like, we don't need everyone to get married. There's some people, men and women, who are like, you're never going to save. They've already decided that it's not for them. And they're just, they're not going to be successful, like lifelong monogamous partners to someone, which is sort of sad. Like, but okay, maybe that's fine. And so I say, God bless, like have a wonderful life. And, you know, our descendants will, you know, spit on your grave. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, not everyone should do it. Like, I've met plenty of people who, like, you know, I wouldn't want to be married to them. Now, I hope they all are extremely happy. I wish everyone happiness. I don't wish ill on anyone, even including my enemies. But yeah, I think that there is, you know, is it the old thing of like, they just haven't met the right girl. But like, how many right girls are left? Like, not a lot.
How do you think that you can find the right girl?
Oh man, maybe this is my second book, Taylor, like the Peachy's Guide to Dating. I don't know.
I find your writing about relationships and marriage extremely interesting.
Oh, good. That's nice. If you're asking me if I can set you up with someone, okay. Yeah.
Sure.
I'll try. I'll put you on the list.
It's just, there's not a lot of people advocating for marriage, and I think it's needed. I think it is an arrangement that would suit most people, and I think they've been tricked out of wanting to pursue it.
People, I think, are scared of, you know, when you lose that like initial crush emotion, that incredible dopamine hit of like falling in love and all that stuff. Like the minute that kind of dissipates a little bit or gets a little bit hard, right? If you're just dating someone, you walk. That would be what you did. Why would you work on that? Why would you stick around? Just get out of there, right? And so for marriage, it does require a like pre-marriage kind of mindset shift, like a pep talk. Like, you know, I was the product of a horrible boomer divorce. Okay. So my siblings and I had to kind of see that from the inside. And yeah, divorce is not, it's not a joke. Like it really can rough you up. And we all survived, we're all fine, like everything's fine. But I always knew, even before I was ever, you know, trying to find a husband or even thinking about a husband, like that's the one thing I don't want. Like I will not get married if I think there's a chance. I'll get divorced. And a lot of people, I think, get engaged for the Instagram photos, you know, for the party and stuff. And they don't really think about like year 2, year 5, year 10, year 20. And they walk down the aisle, and I've heard people say this to me, well, who are engaged, say like, well, it doesn't work out. We can always get divorced. I'm like, well,
it's not going to work out.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like Chekhov's gun, you know, do you know who he is? Yeah. Yeah. So, right.
That's exactly right.
If you say like, it's like, you know, he's an old Russian playwright. If you show a gun in the first act of a play, you know, it's going to get fired in the third act. So if you're saying to yourself, well, we can always, we sometimes fight and I don't know, we can always get divorced. That's a guarantee that you will be calling a divorce lawyer, you know, by year 7. So you have to just have both of you have to be on the same page and willing to like fight it out, because yes, you know, you end up in a foxhole. You have like a bunch of little kids and everyone's throwing up or everyone's sick. Like we've had, it's like, oh. You know, you have to just marry the person that you want here in the foxhole with you, you know, not just the person who like looks really hot or, I mean, you know, that's all great. Like, sure, go for that. But there has to be, you know, this is the person that's going to be like, you know, you're going to survive together on the desert island with that person.
What's your list of marriageable traits that you said somebody is marriage material? What's your list?
I wrote this essay, Operation Marriage Material.
I read it. Yeah,
good. For American Mind. I mean, you know, the obvious things. I mean, I think that, you know, I hate to get too like preachy or whatever, but like you probably aren't going to succeed as a woman if you're like going on getting wasted every night. So like, you know, again, I'm not like saying a teetotaler or whatever, like just moderation. You know, you need to just like exude a vibe of like, you know, this is triggering words for people, but like class and elegance, like go have fun, do whatever you want. But like, if you're like, you know, barfing outside your Uber at 3 a.m, no, you may not, you know, potential husbands like may walk away. You know what I'm saying? And I think at the end of the day, it honestly is about like loyalty. And someone who's had or broken up with a half a dozen people or more, you know, well, why are they going to be loyal to you?
Yeah, that's powerful. I do want to ask you about your Catholicism. I find it interesting. I find a couple things interesting. I find people that have that came from atheism into religion have a very unique perspective on religion. Mm-hmm. And I also find it interesting that you chose Catholicism. So I guess first, how did Catholicism, how did religion come about for you?
Yeah, like I said, I was raised to sort of not just like, you know, not be religious, but really to hate religion. So,
oh, really?
Know, yeah, my parents were, you know, products of, you know, you know, people who had emigrated from Europe over the, you know, centuries and moved to America and had all thrown their religion into the Atlantic Ocean, like yeah. When they got to Ellis Island, right? They had no interest. So none of my grandparents were religious. They all left it all behind. So like everybody in the house like had Christmas trees, right? But there was nothing, it was not associated with any, you know, religious holiday of any kind. You know, my mother would keep a file, you know, like they, where when I went to school and where I lived, people would mock Christianity as just these stupid rubes, these like, you know, peasants, the flyover, the Walmart people, like they were just, look at these ridiculous people. Like that was just in the air. Okay. Mm-hmm. When I was, this is like in, you know, West Los Angeles. Okay. My mother kept a file. I mean, God bless my mother, but she kept a file in her desk, the religion file, and she would have clippings of like things like, you know, bus full of missionaries goes off cliff, everyone really? Dies. Yeah, plane load of Christian missionaries in Africa, like kill.
That's wild.
So she would, and she, because her argument was like, well, where was God? Like, why did they
oh,
let that
man.
Happen? Okay, so that was just like what I was dealing with as a kid. Okay. In every other way, my mother is like very trad. She's very domestic. She's a stay-at-home housewife, you know, super loving and baking cookies, all that stuff. But when it came to that, she was really like really hardcore. And so for me, I had no contact with religion. I scorned it. That's for stupid people. And then my husband had been baptized as a little baby, but he had never been raised with it. He had fallen away. And then we got married, and my first pregnancy ended in a miscarriage, okay, at 12 weeks, which was super sad because we had, like, everything had been fine. We had seen the baby, you know, all that stuff. We were naming it. We were so excited, you know, and then obviously it didn't work out. And it was deeply traumatic for both of us. And he informed me, like, that night, he's like, okay, just wanted to let you know, honey, I'm going to be a Catholic now. And he started RCIA like that as soon as possible and started doing the classes and all that stuff. And my attitude was like, okay, like, whatever. Like, I'm not going to stop you because that felt like really mean. You know, like, I love my husband. If this is what he needs to feel better, like, I guess it's fine, you know. And so he did that whole process and he got baptized as an adult and all that stuff. And then, and his like mentor, whatever they call it, a priest, he would say to this priest, I didn't know this till after I converted later. Like, how do I encourage my wife to convert with me? Like, what should I do? And he said, whatever you do, don't encourage her. Like, don't proselytize. Don't be a missionary. Just like show her by your. Yeah, show her by your example and like just that's it. Like, do not push it. Because, you know, knowing me, if he had pushed it, I would have been like, no way. Are you crazy? You know, because I was not. I had too far to go. Like, my trajectory had to go all the way. Right. And so, I mean, I was already pro-life. Like, I was politically, you know, I was sort of like politically Catholic. Right. but I wasn't really, I didn't believe. And so we started having children and we would baptize the babies and I hadn't converted yet. But my excuse was kind of like, well, I had like three kids under three, you know, like I don't even know where my shoes are. I can't go to Catholic class. I'd have to get dressed. Like I can't do this. I was so tired. And so finally I kind of woke up from the haze of like multiple childbirths, pregnancy, nursing, all that stuff, sleep training. And by that point I had been going to Mass every Sunday, you know, like celebrating all these holidays and like doing a lot of readings and all this stuff that people do when they're kind of exploring. And I met with, you know, this kind of mentor priest, and he was really wonderful. And, it, you know, just over time, I would say it was like a slow erosion of my like brittle, the brittle carapace of my atheism just kind of diminished, and like little cracks formed, little fissures formed. And like, I allowed myself to kind of be open. Like, oh, okay, wait a second. This sounds, wow, okay. And so about 10 years ago, I finally did it. So, you know, but I, as a convert, like you were saying, what's the difference between convert and cradle? As a convert, I have like no tolerance for like the wishy-washy Catholics. Like, are you Catholic? You're Catholic.
I grew up Catholic.
You grew up Catholic, right.
I'm kind of Catholic. I grew up Catholic. I went to Catholic school. I started going to like Protestant church later. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you that I'm more interested in Catholicism since COVID.
That's interesting.
Yeah. The church has changed a lot over the last couple of years. There's been a shift in Christianity in general. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Catholicism is interesting. The tradition, the symbolism, the ritual is very interesting to me.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting that y'all chose, I guess your husband had grown up kind of Catholic. But it's an interesting religion to kind of come into fresh. And I was just curious on what your perspective on it.
I don't think I chose Roman Catholicism. I think it kind of chose me, you know? Uh-huh. And the interesting thing is, and I just put this together much later in life, is that, you know, in high school and college, I had taken various trips to, you know, to Europe, to Western Europe, and I'd always loved the iconography, the Catholic iconography, the cathedrals. I mean, it's a cliche, you know, Michelangelo, Vatican, all this stuff. I'd always been so like just so into it. I went on the pilgrimage route to Santiago de Compostela, you know, and it was just so, so moving and beautiful. And this giant mass with the huge, in Santiago de Compostela, Spain, northern Spain, it's like this windswept, beautiful, and it's like a pilgrimage site. And I was an atheist, okay? But they have this incredibly huge, I forget the name of it, thing that holds all the incense. And they just swing it from like the very roof of the church, the ceiling, and just swings all the way down the aisle. Just this very beautiful, dramatic. And everyone, it's absolutely packed with thousands of people. And there's, you know, the choir. And it's just like, wow. And later I thought, you know, maybe all of that kind of early exposure to the real, the beauty, just the art and the aesthetics of it, were part of the reason I was open to it, because like Protestantism and any other, you know, whatever religious sect or whatever never had any interest to me. Like I had no, like I wouldn't even, like I can't tell a Protestant church from like an office building, you know, like they're just all look the same. And, but the old Catholicism, like the whatever traditional Catholicism has always moved me. And I think you're right. Like, there's something about it that is a little bit mysterious. Like, why does it affect us so deeply? Like, why do we, you know, cry in front of like the Pietà, you know, in the Vatican, which is like, you know, I think just the most moving sculpture. And when you have those early experiences, that exposure to that stuff, you know, maybe it did like subtly lead me over, make me open to it.
You know, I think what Protestants get right is the relationship aspect of it. But I think as the world continues to devolve, there's a real beauty to Catholicism that is in stark contrast to the world that is needed to kind of, it feels holy when you're in those spaces like cathedrals and stuff. It feels set apart from the world, which is really nice. You were saying that you didn't, that you're intolerant of the wishy-washy Catholics. Expand on that. I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, I have no tolerance. Like, you know, some, you know, I think there is like a kind of a dividing line between me and like some of the Catholics I know. Really, you know, comes out when I start going on my like anti-Pope Francis rants. Okay, like, I think, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Pope Francis, and he's not a huge fan of me. You know, he's said that the problem in the church is conservative Catholics, and he's doing everything in his power to crush the traditional Latin Mass, the TLM. And for people who don't know, you know, pre-Vatican II, it was only the Latin Mass was in Latin, and the priests faced away from, you know, the parishioners. And Vatican II made it, you know, the Mass we have today in most churches. And so he is now making it super hard to get to a traditional Latin Mass. I don't go to one regularly, but they're beautiful, and I have friends who do, and it's becoming very difficult. I mean, talk about feeling like a domestic extremist, you know. And the FBI, recently, some FBI office, I think it's St. Louis or something, actually targeted a Latin Mass as a place where domestic extremists were meeting, were going, and which is incredible. But I have less tolerance for things like, you know, the child abuse scandal. Like, I think a lot of that really happened when, you know, if you're raised from birth, this really old school Catholics, you're just raised to, you know, you never disobey a priest, you know, but he's God. Okay. And you don't ever speak badly of them. And he's an agent of God. Like, I think that attitude led to a lot of, you know, the major problems and the travesty that happened and that was overlooked in too many cases. But I see, like, I mean, there was, I think my radicalization really as a Catholic, like an intolerant Catholic, I'm not able to tolerate like liberal Catholicism. There's a guy named, you probably know him, Cardinal Roger Mahoney. He was the, you know, Cardinal of Los Angeles for like 20 years or something. And he was basically the main mover behind all of the Southern California sex abuse scandals. And the church had to settle for like $1 billion, the largest settlement in church history in LA, thanks to him. So he was not an abuser, but he basically protected dozens of like the most abusive nightmare priests you could ever dream of. And he would just move them around, right? So, you know, he's responsible for just like a path of destruction across Southern California in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, he hasn't been defrocked. He lives now as a cardinal emeritus, like a retired cardinal, on the campus of St. Charles Borromeo in North Hollywood. That is just, he just gets to live there and live out his life. And he occasionally will show up to like, you know, big events and stuff at the cathedral downtown. And I remember trying to explain to people when this was all happening, when like the legal case was breaking, like, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago, like, we got to get rid of this guy. Like, we can't have this guy hanging around. And there was some pushback because, well, you know, what the Pope says goes. And I was like, well, forget that. You know, he's got to be thrown out. And of course, he's still there.
When you say that you wanted a more traditional Catholicism, I think of traditional Catholicism as protecting the priests, protecting the infrastructure. So you would say that is an outgrowth of the liberal mindset that infected the church, like post Vatican II.
That's interesting when you think about it. Yeah, when I think of traditional Catholicism, I just think of like, you know, masses that don't have like interpretive dancers and rock music. And priests who, you know, lecture you on that, you know, white parishioners are bad. That happened to me once locally. You know, there's Catholic masses where there's pride flags and trans.
Really?
Drag queen. Yeah. So I think when I think of trad Cath, I'm just thinking of, you know, old school, you know, holy, reverent experiences. That's what you want, right? I don't want a modern experience. If I want to like have modernity, I'll go to the mall, you know, I'll like turn on TV. I want, when I go to mass, like I would love it if it was like, just like, you know, dirt floors and like very primitive, like that, that's what you feel like is real. I don't want modern stuff. Like, I don't like when I see like the altar boys in jeans and flip flops. Do you know what I mean? Like, show some respect.
What's fascinating, I can't even imagine that happening at a mass. We, you know, in South Louisiana, it's very Catholic. If something like that happened, people would revolt. I mean, people would go nuts.
Yeah, my husband was once at one Catholic elementary school we went to. He was like in charge of helping train the altar servers or whatever. And he like very gently suggested that like when the kids are serving, if they could not wear, you know, jean shorts and flip flops. Okay. Just like, you know, put on pants of any kind. Just, we don't need like cutoffs with their butt hanging out and like flip flops when you're actually, you're altar serving. And he got so much pushback from that. Okay. The principal of the school said to him, excuse me, you know, Mr. Keenan, I have to talk to you about this. She was like, you know, I know that you're a little more traditional than us, but I just want you to know that like, we're only sort of Catholic. Or she said something like, we're only medium Catholic and you might be extra Catholic. So this school isn't really going to be okay with those rules. And he was kind of like, all right, you know, I'll pick my battles. So yeah, that's just sort of like the state of affairs of LA Catholicism.
Do you feel like when you were going through your own conversion, that at what point did you change in your heart? And then what did that give you in terms of religious belief? What did that do for you?
I sort of cringe when I talk about like my religious, you know, conversion, and like, it feels very like, I can't ever get away from like my cynical Gen X self, you know, and like that always like fights against that sort of like, you know, that cringe. But I'll just open up here. So like I said before about how Jesus said, you know, love your enemy. And so to be really honest, it was in the course of starting my RCIA, we were just like doing like very close readings of the New Testament, of the gospel. And like I had read some of it in like seventh grade or eighth grade at my like secular, you know, private high school. But we had read it as like just mythology. Okay. Like fables. Mm-hmm. And here I was reading it as like, no, this actually happened. This is real. And so for me, it was reading about how you should try to love your enemies. And like, you know, I forget the exact words, but like, it's easy to love your friends. There's no grace in that. Love your neighbors. That's easy. The difficult thing is to love your enemies. And I was just thinking about like, I don't know, that was like a moment for me where I was like, huh? Like, but no, you're supposed to slay your enemies. You're supposed to destroy your enemies, like love them. And like, why was this guy in like the Roman Empire? Like, where did this idea, how could anyone come up with this? You know, in the first century AD, like this is a lunatic. And honestly, that idea just sort of stayed with me. And I just, you know, what can I tell you? It just, for me, was just like a slow awakening. Yeah, I didn't have like a, you know, road to Damascus moment. It was just honestly being exposed to it in a reverent way for several years. And going to mass where the priest was extremely reverent. And, you know, we would go to this one small mass in... where was it? It was sort of like, it was like in a heavily Latino Filipino neighborhood, sort of like a lower middle class neighborhood. And the priest was this very boisterous Irishman, and he would sternly lecture. And this mass was packed, seating, standing room only, absolutely packed. He was so popular, and he was kind of brutal. And he would say, if you, you know, have not gone to confession and you did this, you may not get communion today. Like, you may not get communion. You need to go to confession. You need to pray the rosary every day. You need to do this, this, and this. I am not giving you communion. If you are living in sin, if you're doing this, get out. Like, he was beloved for that, okay? He was a thing. It was like people would come from all over the city to be yelled at, okay? It was like tough love, but it was this is, wow. And I was, you know, for me, it was great to hear because I was like, oh, okay. Like, I needed this because I had no one telling me this kind of stuff. Like, this is like, you can't kind of be, you know, a little bit Catholic, a little bit pregnant. Like, for me, it was like all in or nothing, right? And so I was like, well, I'm going to be all in. And then he later got moved to a different parish, and they brought in one of those like wishy-washy priests with like kind of like limp wrists, and his palms were moist when he would shake your hand, just like a kind of a creepo. And guess what? No one goes to that mass anymore. Like, all those people who were crowding in vanished. They all moved to different parishes. I think he has a few little old ladies in there, but it was really proof that people are looking for something kind of like, you know, whatever, old fashioned, but like what feels real. And the truth is very uncomfortable for people in this era to hear. Like, it's very triggering. It's hate speech. Okay, but people want it. And there is a lot of vibrancy and a lot of life happening in parishes where the priests are like no nonsense. And so that's nice to know, but it's still a very small minority of Catholics.
Well, you know, it actually kind of goes back to what we started talking about, was like, you can't be mean. You know, I think the world defines it right. as mean because they want you to feel bad about it. But right. I think there is a real attraction to having standards. And I think that's actually the attraction of the traditional Latin Mass. And I think the growth of the Orthodox Church. I mean, the Orthodox Church is exploding right now.
It's because
it's the standards is what it is. It's like, if you don't stand for anything, you're not attractive at all. The attraction is saying this is the way. And right. I don't think the church understands that.
Yeah, they've forgotten that. I mean, it's like, you know, the parent who won't give the child ice cream for breakfast, and the your kid screams, "You're so mean." You know, okay. Well, no. Like, you think I'm mean, but I'm actually, I say this all the time. You think I'm mean because I won't let you do this or whatever, but it's because I'm nice, actually. Like, it feels mean to you, but a bad mommy would give you ice cream at, like, you know, 7 a.m. or midnight. Like, only a bad mommy who was mean would do that. A nice mommy is trying to make sure you don't get, you know, diabetes. And so I think that a lot of the kind of like strict priests are also like that. They're actually being very nice to you because they're trying to, like, whatever, save souls, you know, get you to heaven, make us all saints. And so, which is very nice. But yeah, people come from this sort of like liberal, like, you know, victimhood, harm sensitivity, microaggression mindset, where it feels mean. You're feeling judged for your lifestyle and all your flaws. And it's like, well, of course, that's right. That's what we're doing here. That's right. And you can go and make an examination of conscience, and you can be absolved. It's easy.
Well, it's a society without shame. We're not used to feeling any sense of shame about anything.
Exactly.
And it's like, well, that shame, you can't even grow. You can't do anything.
Right. Shame, for lack of a better word, is good.
Yeah, that's
true. To paraphrase Gordon Gekko.
Do you feel different in your day-to-day life, like emotionally, since your conversion? Or is it more of an intellectual conversion that you've convinced, you know, and I struggle with that. You know, I think I live in a very much an intellectual space with God, and I, you know, try not to be. But do you sense a difference in the way that you see the world?
That's a really impossible for me to answer. I mean, a lot of my friends who are Catholic will, you know, we'll be discussing some, like, you know, calamity of the world or whatever. And someone will suggest, like, well, we need to pray more. We need to fast more. We need to pray more. And I'm like, I'm all for that. That's great. But also, like, we need to go buy guns, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but also we need to go do practical stuff. So, and I think that's fine with them, but I think that that's like hard for me to shift right to, you know, going to like God or prayer as your first resort. That's to me always been like, well, the last resort. Like, I'll pray when I might. But, and I'm working on that, obviously. It's an evolution. But I think that the big thing in terms of just a daily mindset is, I think, very basic, which is like thinking about your own death. And when you're secular, when you're atheist, you know, you live in terror of ever ever, you know, death is like just a terrifying, avoid at all costs, you know, let's live forever. Let's never grapple with our mortality. Believe me, like that, you know, I still struggle with that. But I do think that sometimes when I'm like, you know, feeling my age and another birthday or, you know, oh no, like this is all going to end. It's like, it honestly, I mean, this again, like maybe it's just corny, but it does give me a like much more peace or whatever. Like, you know, if I'm not like my grandma, my great grandmother, my Eastern European grandmother, you know, she threw all her religion into the sea when she arrived in New York, and she would say in her thick accent, "When you die, you rot. You rot in your coffin. You die. That's it. Like nothing was going to happen to you. There was no heaven. You were just going to, your body would rot and that would be it." And so that is a very bleak way to go through life. And she lived till 106. So, I mean, I guess it served her well. But for me, it is a source of peace, let me just say.
I think at its root, you know, you jokingly say that, you know, becoming a domestic extremist is the thing that'll save your family and save the world. And I think that's definitely true. But I also think that it is practically about joy while living, right? How would you define, for somebody that's interested in this lifestyle, interested in your book, interested in the values that you're expressing, how would you define a life well lived?
I think that, you know, one of the things I do personally is that I think a lot about, like, you know, my deathbed. And what are the things, maybe this is a total cliche, but like, what would my big regrets be, you know, at that moment of my life? Like, and I just always think about like, well, if I have like some or most or all of my children around, maybe a bunch of grandchildren there, and they all have like generally positive feelings about me, like there's no one who, you know, is trying to smother me with a pillow, you know, spiking my IV with cyanide or whatever. If everyone generally like thinks fondly of me at the very end, I mean, that's it for me. And obviously, I mean, I say this a lot in the book, but I think that one measure of that and how to increase joy is through the production of your ancestors and having grandchildren and then them having great-grandchildren. I mean, you know, this is the oldest tale as old as time, but I, you know, I haven't had a little baby in my life for a long time. Not long. I mean, well, it's been a few years, but I really look forward to that very first grandchild. And that actually, I hate aging. Like my biggest sin and my biggest flaw is vanity. Okay. So like aging, it sucks and I hate it, but whatever. Okay. I'm fine with it. Because I know that I will be handed a grandchild one day. And like, I can't even wrap my brain. It feels like I just had my firstborn, you know, and in a few years he'll be going off to college or right wing bodybuilder school or wherever they go now, Hustler Academy, right?
Yeah.
But I'm really hoping that before too long, you know, that I hope that he will get married relatively young, hopefully, and hand me a grandchild. And I just, to me, that's like, you know, that's my EGOT, you know, that's my Emmy, my Grammy, my Oscar, my Tony, is that kid. And hopefully I'll get a lot of them. And that to me, like my mother and my in-laws, they always, all they talk about is how many grandchildren they have, okay? And they like compete with other friends. And they each have way more, of course, thanks to my hard work, okay? It's all me, okay? Their numbers got artificially inflated because I was very prolific. And they just like mog all their friends. Like, oh, how are your two grandchildren doing these days? You know, well, let me tell you about my 15. Yeah. And so that's just a super thrill. Like if you're in your mid 70s, like what could be better?
That's perfect. That's a great answer. Well, Peachy, thank you for doing this. I appreciate your writing. The book is Domestic Extremism, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. Everybody should go read Peachy on the American Mind, which is great. That's coming out pretty regularly. I read it all the time. I also subscribe to your Substack, which is great. Thank you again for doing this. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Yeah, and just if you don't mind, I can add a few links.
No, but pitch, go ahead.
You should subscribe to my Substack, peachykeenan.substack.com. You can find me on Twitter. I'm on there all the time, at Keenan Peachy. And if you'd like to pre-order my book or learn more about it, you can go to my author website, peachykeenanwrites.com.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Taylor.